Had you planned on becoming a sports announcer?
No, I never even entered my mind about being a sports announcer, about being in radio. I used to like to be in the hometown theatricals in Sanford, Florida. And in those days, you used to have minstrel shows, and I liked to be in them. And that was my only touch with what you might say show business. Then after I got out of high school in Sanford, Florida, I worked for 2.5 years just doing odd jobs, so just a day laborer. And I got convinced that I wasn't going to go very far doing that, and that maybe while I didn't have any money, the percentage was better if I just went up to the University of Florida and worked my way through and exposed myself, you say, to a college education. And I had one odd job after another to stay in school. And by a fluke, in the latter half of my second year, I was offered an opportunity on the campus radio station, WRUF, at 35 cents an hour. And I didn't particularly want to do it. I wasn't interested in doing it. I had a job waiting tables. I had a job as janitor at a bachelor professor's club for my room. So I didn't need another job, and I was busy. But the director at the radio station, kept after me and this, that, and the other. And finally, I decided, well, I'll take it, try it. And I fell in love with radio. And life has surprises for you. You go around another corner. And after I'd been at the station about half a year and still hadn't thought seriously about staying in radio, I was still a college student. This was just a means to stay in school. The fellow who had the only good job on the station quit. They offered me the job, but with the stipulation that it would be full-time. In other words, I couldn't continue broadcasting part-time at the station and going to school full-time. And by that time, I realized that I really did like radio, and so I took it, and here I am.
Can you tell us the story of how you first hooked up with the Dodgers?
Say this again?
Can you tell us the story of how you first started broadcasting for the Dodgers?
For the Dodgers? Well, that came along after I'd been broadcasting for 9 years, Terry. I stayed 4 years at WRUF at Gainesville, Florida, and then 5 years in Cincinnati. And the way I broadcast for the Dodgers, again, another person enters your life. The general manager of the Cincinnati Reds, when I got there, was Larry MacPhail. He came into the big leagues in 1934. He and I met at Cincinnati and began our big league careers, you might say, at the same time. He had nothing to do with bringing me to Cincinnati. We just met there. I had been to Cincinnati a couple of times to WLW, taking auditions, looking for another job. So MacPhail was at Cincinnati 3 years. And then he was out of baseball a year. And then they brought him in to take over the Dodgers in 1938. He decided he wanted to go on the radio in 1939. And MacPhail made the decision that the announcer he wanted when he went on the radio in 39 was Barber, who had been, his announcer out of Cincinnati. So that's how I got to Brooklyn. It was MacPhail's decision.
It's an interesting tradition in baseball that announcers are affiliated with the ball club as opposed to the broadcasting outlet or the sponsor of the game. Was it always that way?
No. I think I can answer the question specifically. I believe I'm the first announcer that was signed by a ball club. When I went to Cincinnati, I went to work on the staff of the Crosley Radio Corporation, WLW, WSAI. Mr. Crosley had two stations. He also was the new president and principal owner of the Cincinnati Reds. But the 5 years I was in Cincinnati, I had no connection with the ball club at all, outside of the fact that I came to the ballpark and did the games. I was on the staff of the Crosley Radio Corporation. And when broadcasting began in New York, and I'll have to tell you that the Giants, Yankees, and the Dodgers, and a lot of other ball clubs in 1933 were afraid of the effect of radio broadcasting. They were fearful that the radio reports would keep people from coming to the ballpark, especially on days of threatening weather. And the Giants, Yankees, and Dodgers executed a 5-year anti-radio ban. There was no broadcasting permitted of any of those three teams' games for 5 years, and the fifth and final year was 38. I said earlier that MacPhail said he was going to broadcast in 39. He believed in radio. He thought it was a very positive influence, as well as bringing him revenues. So MacPhail broke the ban, in effect. And when he went on the air, that forced the Johnson Yankees to go on the air. And the people that brought me to do the Brooklyn games were the sponsors, notably General Mills, sponsor of Wheaties. They were the ones who put up the money for the broadcast. They were the ones who hired the radio station, gave MacPhail $70,000, I think, in 1939. So General Mills brought me legally, tactically, financially to Brooklyn, although MacPhail had stipulated that I had to be the announcer. So I was the first fella then to be hired by a sponsor and not by a station. Well, I remained working for sponsors, different sponsors as they came and as they went, until MacPhail, who had left Brooklyn after the season of 42, went into the Army, and he came out of the Army, and he and Dan Topping and Delaware bought the Yankees in 1945. And in 1945, MacPhail called me and offered me the job of broadcasting the Yankee games, starting the next year, 1946, and gave me a three-year contract. But I elected to stay in Brooklyn. But in order to stay in Brooklyn, when I went back and told Branch Rickey, who was then running the Brooklyn Club, that MacPhail had made me the offer, Mr. Rickey said, well, I'm going to make you an offer because it behooves the Brooklyn Ball Club to secure the announcer of their choice to them. So when Rickey made me a counteroffer, which I accepted, I then was signed by the Brooklyn Ball Club. So I was the first announcer to be signed by a sponsor and taken away from the station. And I was the first announcer to be signed by a ball club. So from then on, I think all of the contracts of the broadcasters, by and large, have been with the ball club. That set a pattern. MacPhail then hired Mel Allen and put him on a contract to the Yankees. And so that was the procedure that followed. And I'm sure that all of the announcers now are signed by the teams.
Has that ever been controversial, since in broadcasting is so involved with the notion of subjectivity? The fact that the announcer would be affiliated with the club means that they'd be biased towards that team during the broadcasts of a game.
Well, this brings, you could write a book about it. I was very fortunate. MacPhail did not want a propagandist. Neither did Rickey. And when I went to the Yankees, I was brought to the Yankees by George Weiss. He didn't either. They felt that a propagandist was weakness, that the public would stop believing because they said, well, MacPhail said to me, you are closer to your job, to your microphone, than anybody else. You broadcast the game as you see it. And if my ball club needs to be burned, you burn it. Mr. Rickey was of the same opinion, and so was George Weiss. I never heard from Weiss in the years that he and I were together at Yankee Stadium. So I was very fortunate to have that background. I understand today that a lot of the owners want the announcers to definitely shade in favor of the ball club. They like to hear it that way. They think the fans like it that way. So most of the broadcasters today, from my understanding, are what you might say rooters to a degree. They say, our boys, they say, we need a run, or something like that. I never did. Bill Clem, I think, was the greatest umpire we ever had. And he told me one time that umpiring was really very simple. You umpired the ball. It wasn't, you just, when you said safe or out, fair or foul, you umpired the ball. What the ball? It wasn't the tying run or the winning run or the pennant clinching game. You just umpired the ball. And I tried to broadcast the ball. That made it a very, very simple working philosophy for me. And it was very easy for me to move from Brooklyn after the season of 53 and 15 years at Brooklyn across the river, two rivers, in fact, to Yankee Stadium and start broadcasting the Yankees. And there was no confusion. People understood when they heard me announce that I was giving them the ball game.
So there was never any problem about you switching loyalties?
No. I think that Walter O'Malley, this was one of the reasons I left Brooklyn, after he got control of the ball club and ousted Ricky, I think O'Malley definitely wanted to have an announcer that he felt was, you know, for his team more and more. And he used to say little things to me like, well, the boys tell me. He never defined who the boys were. The boys tell me that you don't root very much for the Dodgers. And little things like that. And that began to tell me, well, if he's repeating that, that's what he's thinking. And that had much to do with my decision to leave Brooklyn. I quit at Brooklyn.
Red Barber is my guest, if you're just joining us. You were broadcasting for the Dodgers during one of the most important periods in baseball history, and that is when Jackie Robinson joined the major leagues. Can you recall for us what it was like the first time you announced a game when he was playing?
There is nothing, Terry, for me to recall about the first time that I announced a game when he was playing, because I had to go through a period of self-examination a long time before I ever knew there was a ball player by the name of Robinson, or before Mr. Ricky knew there was a ball player by the name of Robinson. Branch Rickey and I had luncheon in March of 1945. And he told me then, in complete secrecy, that he had made up his mind that he was going to bring a Negro to the Dodgers. And he explained to me the procedure that he was going to undertake to do it. And a part of that procedure was that he was going to put a team in the then existing Negro League called the Negro Brown Dodgers, because he knew that there could not be publicity about his search, his intentions to bring a black player to the white Dodgers. And so he knew that if he put a team in the Negro League, he could then assign his scouts, and they would know for whom they were searching, to go around and evaluate black ball players all over the country and in the Caribbean. And his chief scouts began doing that shortly thereafter for the Brooklyn Brown Dodgers. But their reports on the black players, the outstanding black players, all came to Mr. Ricky, and he studied them. And out of these reports, the name of Robinson kept coming up more and more frequently with his physical abilities, until Mr. Ricky decided that this was the player who could do it physically. He'd never seen him, but his scouts all said he could do it. But Ricky had to decide, was this the man who spiritually could also do it? But that's another story. So he told me in March of 1945 what he was going to do, and that all of baseball was opposed to breaking the color line, and his family was opposed to him doing it because they said that you're too old, he was then in his middle 60s, and that you're not well enough, that this will be just too crushing a burden for you. But he was determined to do it. Why? That's another story. Well, so when he told me that in principle and bound me to silence except to tell my wife, I was shocked, Terry. I'd been born in Mississippi. I grew up in Central Florida. As the song in South Pacific says, I'd been carefully taught. This really shook me. And my first reaction when I went home and told my wife, I said, I'm going to quit. I don't want to be a part of this. And she said, well, you don't have to quit right now. Let's think about it a little bit. Let's sit down and have a martini. And as I began to think for the next few days and weeks and months, because Ricky didn't meet Robinson until, late that year, August, I began to realize several things. One, that this was the best sports announcing job in the world, and I'd helped create it, and that I should be careful before I tossed it aside. Two, I got to thinking, well, I had no control over the parents I was born to. I had nothing to say about being born white any more than somebody had to say about being born black. Therefore, I ought to be careful about getting a false sense of pride about the color of my skin. It was an accident of birth. That gave me a little more realistic humility, let us say. And then I remembered what Judge Landis, the first commissioner of baseball, told the assembled broadcasters 1935 before the World Series, then all three networks broadcast. He said, this is in essence, he said, you men are here to report the World Series on radio. There are two teams of players that are here, and they're going to play. Now, you men report how they play. Don't try to play for them. Don't be critical of their playing. Just report how they play. And there are two managers, and they'll make the decisions. And don't you fellows try and manage. You just report the decisions that these managers make. That's all you're supposed to do. And there will be four umpires, and certainly don't try to help them umpire. Just report their decisions. And that word report, it stuck in my mind and became part of my working philosophy. And I tried, from then on, I tried to report what was happening in a ball game. And as a saving grace, I remembered Landis was then dead. They say the voice from the grave is very imperative. I remembered Landis saying, report. And suddenly, in a flash, it was beautifully simple. I realized who I was and what I was supposed to do. I wasn't Branch Rickey. I wouldn't be the manager of the Dodgers when the player came. I wouldn't be the ball players who would play with him. I wouldn't be the ball players who would play against him. I wouldn't be the fans who would be in the stands. I wasn't a sociologist. I wasn't a racist. Who was I? I was a reporter. What was I to do about the black player? To report what he did. Just report it. And that's all I did about Robinson, and that's all Robinson needed, and that's all Mr. Rickey wanted. And that's all the public apparently wanted. And I don't recall getting any criticism from anybody about those broadcasts. And when it started, it was the hottest microphone in the history of radio, especially with a fella from Mississippi with a Southern voice. But the reporting was what did it.
There were a lot of occasions where a value judgment had to be made. Like, say, a player was sliding and trying to intentionally spike him, or say someone was throwing a ball and trying to intentionally hit him. But who could tell if it was intentional or an accident, the player doing?
No, you can't do that. This is why our broadcast has to be very careful, especially about a ball being thrown at a pitcher's head. You can't say it's intentional. If you do that, you're going to get in criminal liability. You're giving a pitcher criminal intent. You report the path of the ball. You report the actions of the hitter. If the ball hits him, you try and report the spot on the head, and you report the scene that follows. You report it, and the Judge Landis dictum, report. You don't try and read intent. If a ball player spikes somebody, you don't try and read intent. You can report that maybe the player who was spiked thought he was and starts to fight, or his teammates start a fight, or they got a big rhubarb going, but you don't get into intent.
Have you ever asked yourself what the outcome would have been of integration in baseball if it hadn't been Jackie Robinson, who was the first black in the major leagues?
I haven't asked myself too much about that, Terry. After all, I lived through it. And as you know, the book I wrote last year features it, 1947, when all hell broke loose in baseball. But I know this, that, and I've thought about it, if Mr. Rickey had not made his decision to break the color line, there wouldn't have been a Jackie Robinson, because there wouldn't have been a black player, certainly for some years. I don't know who would have broken it when. I think, it finally would have been done, I guess. But it wouldn't have been done nearly as soon. Rickey set something tremendously in motion. Robinson was a fairly old player, as ball players go, when he came to Brooklyn. We don't know how great he would have been had his earlier years in professional baseball. But I don't think there would have been, we never would have heard of Jackie Robinson if Rickey had not made his decision and moved when he did.
My guest is Red Barber, if you're just joining us. In your book about Jackie Robinson, 1947, when all hell broke loose, you tell a story about Leo DeRocha and how he basically stopped a team petition against Robinson from being brought to Rickey. Can you tell the story of how he did that?
Yes, I was not there. You have to remember, Terry, and people listening in, when Mr. Rickey made his decision, it set a great deal of turbulence in motion. All of baseball was against him, and there were a lot of writers who were opposed to it. Everybody was taking sides, and there were all sorts of threats that were made. Robinson had sometimes a police protection, and his mail was checked by the FBI and this and the other. There were threats at times that people were going to shoot into the ballpark. It was very serious. Robinson was with Montreal in 46, and Mr. Rickey put him there because he felt, and quite correctly, that there would not be the racial strains in Montreal. With their French population, and that went well. Although there was trouble around the American Association, there was trouble in Jersey City and Newark. There was trouble in Louisville. Anyhow, they got that year in pretty well. But in spring training of 47, Robinson was kept on the Montreal squad. Both teams were trained in Cuba. But Robinson stayed on the Montreal squad. Of course, everybody expected him to come over to the Brooklyn squad. They didn't know when. But Mr. Rickey, for his own reasons, had him with Montreal. And part of spring training in 47 was to send Montreal and the Dodgers for 10 days barnstorming in Panama. And the Dodgers were quartered at military barracks and somewhere else on the Isthmus. The Royals were quartered. And shortly after the Dodgers got to Panama, and they didn't take any writers with them, I don't think it was, I know I didn't go as a broadcaster. And this is one of the reasons that the story did not get out. That DeRocher was told, well, in fact, Kirby Higbee, told the Rhodes secretary, Harold Parrott, that there was a petition about to be circulated among the Dodger players, petitioning Rickey not to bring the black player to the team. Well, this, of course, would have been very serious. That's drawing a line. And I think Dixie Walker and Eddie Stanky were supposed to be involved in it, and Bobby Bregan. Well, once Parrott knew about it, he went to DeRocher and told Leo. And Leo checked around all day, just trying to say little things and said nothing, until finally he was convinced by his listening and being around the ball players as they worked out during the day that, yes, there was this petition. So as Leo told the story, he went to bed. And Mr. Rickey wasn't there. As I said, the writers weren't there. And Leo said, I lay there in the bed, and I thought to myself, well, why am I temporizing? Because if they sign that petition, it's going to wreck this ball club. It's going to mean that Mr. Rickey's going to have to get rid of maybe half the players or something. I don't know how far it'll go. So Leo said, I jumped out of bed, and I ordered my coaches to get all the players and round them up, bring them down into a big room downstairs. And in they came in the pajamas and underwear, whatever it was. They got them all out of bed. And Rickey and DeRocher laid the law down. He said, I understand you fellas are going to sign a petition. And in his very blunt language, he said, I'll tell you what you can do with that petition. I won't tell you on the air what he told him. And he said, I just want to warn you fellas that if you sign any petition, Mr. Rickey's going to get rid of you. You're going to be gone. And he said, I want to tell you something else that you might just as well understand, that from all I have seen and all I have heard, this Robinson is a great player, and he is going to put money in our pockets. He's going to help us win. And he said, I don't care what a ball player's color is or who he is. If he can help me win, I want him, and I'm going to play him. And he said, I'll tell you fellas something else. He is just the first of these black players who are coming. And he said, they are hungry, and they have ability, and they're going to come fighting and scratching and clawing, and they're going to take your jobs if you're not careful. They're going to take it away from you. Now, you forget all about that petition, and you don't say anything to anybody about it, and you get up there and go to bed. Well, Rickey flew in the next morning. Parrott had sent for him. And Mr. Rickey, according to Leo's book, and according to Parrott's book, Rickey got Walker and Stanky and Bregan in his room the next morning. And as Leo said, I never heard the old man as angry, as mad. He really, he tore into him. But Fortunately, there were no writers there, and nobody said anything. That story was never written until it came out in Leo's book and in Harold Parrott's book. But it was DeRocher who first really stemmed the tide of the anti-black feeling.
Was the American League slower to integrate than the National League?
Why
do you think that was?
Well, people just didn't want to do it. Things are different. Integration of anything comes very slowly, Terry. People hate to open their eyes. People don't want to change. There are a lot of people that have been carefully taught.
My guest is Red Barber, if you're joining us, sportscaster, National Public Radio Morning Edition commentator, and the author of a recent book about Jackie Robinson titled 1947, When All Hell Broke Loose. Do you think that the
National... Let me make a correction. The American League, as a whole, was slower to integrate. But Bill Veeck, running the Cleveland Indians, in 1947, signed Larry Doby. So the American League was integrated in that year of 47.
You've spent a lot of time with the National League and the American League. What do you think are some of the differences in the spirit of each league? I mean, we know what some of the technical differences are, but other than that, did you see any differences between the two?
Well, that's a very hard question to answer. One difference that you could say in fairly modern times was the fact that the National League much more quickly and universally went for the black ball players than did the American League. And therefore, the National League got a jump on the American League by the fact that it was using more black ball players. Otherwise, I don't know about the differences. People talk about differences in umpiring, difference in pitching, difference in hitting. I think so much of it depends on the personnel of the players involved. Ted Williams is going to hit in any league. Babe Ruth will hit in any league. The league didn't have anything to do with it. Carl Hubbell is going to pitch a winning ball game in any league. I don't think that.
Do you think the two leagues would ever join together?
Will ever be together? Well, I don't know why they should be together. Why should they be together?
What are the advantages of having two leagues?
I don't know that they are. The advantages are that they compete against each other. Otherwise, if you didn't have two leagues, you wouldn't have the World Series.
Yeah, which brings us to the World Series. Now, you've announced a lot of World Series games. How do you, as an announcer, prepare for the series?
As an announcer, you don't prepare any different from the World Series than you do from any other game. Preparation, when you realize that you're doing an ad lib event, doing the play-by-play of a baseball game, my knowledge is, that preparation is maybe 90%. You've done your job almost before you go into the booth. You know the players. You have the records available. You have statisticians. But also you have been checking. You know if anybody's hurt, if anything has happened to anyone. You know why this man is playing, why this one is not playing. And as far as a World Series, when a ball game starts, it's a ball game. It's 90 feet between bases and three strikes, four balls, and the thing that if you're doing a World Series, you had better forget that you're doing a World Series. By this, I mean, if you sat at this microphone and you began to think of how many millions of people were going to be tuned in, how many stations were going to be carrying the radio broadcast, how many stations were going to carry the telecast, you couldn't stand it. It's too much pressure. In my case, I always sat in the booth and I tried to go over my scorebook and the commercial copy and anything else that was pertinent to the assignment. And then I made myself realize that there was the game on the field and there was one microphone that I talked into. And as far as I was concerned, I was not talking to millions of people or hundreds of people or anybody. I was talking into this one little microphone. And to me, that one little microphone, as this one is right now, is very personal. I'm talking much more to this microphone than I am to you.
Do you think that there's ever too many people in the booth now doing color casting and announcing?
Yes, I have said publicly, and of course, I have a hearing problem. I don't hear in my left ear at all and only partially in my right. And when you get three men in a booth, it is very difficult for me to make heads or tails out of what any of them are saying. And I have said that it sounded to me at times, with three men in a booth, that there was a better contest in the booth for the microphone than there was down on the playing field.
Which do you prefer doing, announcing on television or radio, and what are some of the differences in your style on each medium?
Naturally, I'd prefer to do radio, because with radio, you are the artist. People cannot see the game except through your eyes and from your words and from the occasional sound effects that come in. You are free as long as you are staying with the game, keeping it straight. You're free to talk about the third baseman if he's doing something you want to. You're free to talk about the woman in the red hat sitting in the box seat back of first if you want to. You're free to talk about the wind blowing the flag in, above the center field fence if you want to. Anything you want to talk about as long as you keep the game going at radio. You're free, and you don't have to ask anybody, and nobody's editing you. You're it. In television, it's just the reverse. I guess some years ago, I prayed for humility, and I got it when television came along, because instead of being the supreme broadcaster, I became, you might say, the low man on the totem pole. Because when you're on TV, you're sitting with a monitor in front of you, which shows what the audience is seeing. The director out in the truck or in the studio in the stadium, he, through all of his cameras, he is calling the shots. And these shots are changing faster than the eye can register. And you must stay in synchronization with what's on the picture. You can't talk about the woman in the red hat back of first base if the camera is on the picture. You've got to talk about what the picture is. And also, you can't start to tell a story on television. You can't make an observation particularly. You must use little phrases because this picture is going to be changing. And you must be able to change your words with it. And you are the monkey on the string. And a lot of people are pulling that string. And you don't have any control over it at all. You just sit there and do it.
When sports were first broadcast on television, did you think that was going to make a significant difference amongst the fans, or did you think that would just be a flash in the pan?
I was fortunate by the changes and chances of this mortal life to be at Ebbets Field and to be the announcer for the first telecast of a big league ballgame. That was in August 26th, 1939. First game of a Saturday doubleheader at Brooklyn, Cincinnati there. And I felt then that this, something's coming. You know, and for me to tell you that I could visualize the ramifications, no. But you knew that when you were beginning to put pictures with sound, you knew something was bound to happen. Well, nothing much happened during World War II because the military couldn't see any advantage of television during World War II, and it went into the deep freeze to save materials and to save men. But after World War II, television exploded. And my goodness, you were almost in self-defense. People were going from radio to TV, and the people who didn't get summoned over to TV, that were left in radio, gave up on themselves. When television began coming after World War II, radio gave up on itself. And I think it took almost a generation of broadcasters to restore radio back to its proper dignity and usefulness and efficiency and the realization that radio has a role to play that television does not, and that radio can do things, many things that television can't do.
When you're tuning into a game and you have the choice between radio and television, say you're at home, which will you choose for baseball?
I switch around, Terry. I don't bother, for example, in the last World Series, I didn't bother turning on the TV set for the pregame stuff. And that they were filling to get in more commercials and going over and stuff. And, you know, and this endless introducing of the players. After all, you have to remember, I'm not a fan in any sense of the word. And that was wasting my time. I had something else to do. But by when they were ready to play the game, I would have the TV on, and maybe I would have the TV on with the sound for a while, and then maybe I would switch the sound off and turn on the radio sound to see how that was doing. But that, again, adds to the confusion because you'd have radio commercials and this, that, and the other that it'd be against what the TV had. But then there was something else I did, which, of course, with my background, I could do it very easily. The TV coverage is so good, was so excellent, that I was able to turn off all sound and look at the newspaper and look at a book or something and look up once in a while and see what the ball game was doing. And if something came along and I wanted to put the sound on, I put the sound back on again. But also I was perfectly free to go do something else for a couple of innings if I wanted to. I'm not anymore the servant of the tube. I'm free. I'm past 72. I'm out of the restrictions of Social Security and pensions, and I'm on good terms with my wife. And I like to think that I'm freer now than I've ever been. Nobody can tell me I've got to do a program, or nobody can say you've got to say this or not say that.
You've done football announcing as well
yes.
as baseball, and football is really competing now both for the attention of fans and for time on television, and it seems that even like the World Series is scheduled around football games in some ways. Do you enjoy football? Like, do you have any preferences as far as announcing or viewing football or baseball?
For me, the perfect broadcasting sport is baseball because it goes in an orderly fashion. The right fielder stays in right field, and if there's going to be any change, there's an announcement made, and you know it. You have time between pitches. You have time between outs, and you have the opportunity to really broadcast a baseball game, and you have no problem of name identification. Football, I started broadcasting football games in 1930 and continued to do football through 1966. But football, and I did professional football as well as college football. I did eight Orange Bowl games, a Sugar Bowl, a couple of Rose Bowls. I guess I did so much baseball and 13 World Series that people seem to associate me with baseball and not remember that I guess football didn't make much of an impact. That I did all this football. I was with CBS for 9 years, football all over the country. I succeeded Ted Husing there. But football from the beginning of 1930 to 1966, and as I still see it on the television now and hear it on the radio, football is still organized confusion. The coaches themselves don't know what's going on in a football game until they get the film, and they play the film backwards and forwards and backwards and forwards to find out. It's very difficult to know what's going on. I used to think to myself when I was broadcasting football, because you have to go with the ball and identify who's touching the ball, that I wouldn't blame linemen, you know, tackles and guards in the center if they boycotted me and said, you're unfair to us. You never talk about us because you don't get a chance to really talk about those fellas who are down there in the mines doing the infantry work.
Do you think baseball has become too corporate?
Let me say that I don't think baseball is the sport that it once was. When I came up to the big leagues in 1934, baseball was definitely a sport. It was considered a sport by the owners. You didn't have a rich man. You had an occasional rich man, Tom Yawkey, Colonel Rupert. You had certain men of wealth, but they plowed their wealth back into the ball club. And it wasn't a capital gains business. And they seemed to enjoy winning. Colonel Rupert used to spend the money for the Yankees. He built the Yankees with money. He bought Babe Ruth. He didn't develop the great Yankees. Ed Barrett didn't have time. They used money. And so, but Rupert's idea was, I'd like to have a ball club that'll win 154 games every year if we could. He wanted to win. And I think that was truly the pattern. And the other owners, there were a lot of owners who lived on the revenue. Clark Griffith at Washington and others, they only got what they got from the gate. And maybe from some advertising signs on the fence and from selling scorecards and what they got from the commissioner, maybe in trading a ball player. I know Branch Rickey at St. Louis used to survive by the dealing ball players and selling them. It was very much a sport and a business within a sport. Now, with all the television money and the fact that and when I came up in 34, all the ballparks had been built and were owned by the owners. And now you've got ballparks that are built by cities. Your ballpark here in Philadelphia is built by the city. The ball club merely rents it, in effect. And they have pretty good contracts, I understand. And the last ballpark that was built with private money was Dodger Stadium in Los Angeles. O'Malley built the ballpark, but the city of Los Angeles had given him the real estate. And now you've got wealth and rich man's egos and all sorts of tax evasion schemes, tax deduction schemes, and the whole thing has changed to where I would have to say it is a business. It's just a business. It is, and football is a business. The television money is just unbelievable. College football is a business. Goodness, the fellows that are playing college football, they're not really there for a college education. They're almost hired hands.
Do you think there's any way of reversing that trend?
No, I don't think there's, because you've got, this is a civilization that's going on. I think that sooner or later, I think what's going to happen is I think that the colleges are going to realize that they should make their football program an adjunct to the educational program and not take the artificial subterfuge that we're trying to educate students. One of these days, somebody is going to be smart enough to unionize these college players and say, look, you're the show. Here are all these millions of dollars that they're getting from television and getting from attendance, and you're the show, and you're the only reason that this money is involved. You ought to be getting more money. And if the colleges don't do something about that, all of a sudden you're going to have the players, I think. I would think to it. Because the players are the only entertainers that I know in show business, the college players, who are not getting paid sufficiently.
Well, those players are getting paid so much money now, and some people think that it's absurd. That
you mean the professional players?
The professional players, yeah. Do you think that there should be a limit on that? Or
I don't know how you can limit it. I think that professional baseball is going to find it's going to have to limit itself, because I think they've made so many extravagant contracts in which they have obligated themselves for so much money down the road, so to speak, that before long they're going to run into some hard times.
Well, we're about out of time. I know you have another appointment to get to. There's one more thing I want to know. On days when you were announcing lots of games and the schedule was very tight, did you find yourself dreaming games and dreaming announcing, as some people do when they've been really deeply involved in something through the day?
No. To me, broadcasting was a business of reporting. And the only dream that I ever had when I was announcing, sometimes I would have, and I think it would be very understandable, I never ask anybody to try and interpret it because I didn't think it needed an interpretation. I used to have a nightmare in which I would be trying to get to the ballpark and couldn't get there. You know, I'd take a car and it would break down. I'd take a streetcar and it would stop, and I'd start down a road and it would dead end. I think that's what you call a professional hazard dream. That's the only one I ever had.
Well, you've been such an important figure in the development of baseball. It's really been such a pleasure to meet you, and I enjoy your broadcasts on Morning Edition, and I grew up in Brooklyn while you were
thank you.
Broadcasting there, so thanks.